Today, we dive into the world of nonprofit management with Nehemiah Lamb, founder of Unique Individual Ranch. From the challenges of working with neurodiverse children to building supportive communities and effective sponsorship acquisition, this episode is packed with insights and strategies for creating a safe and inclusive environment for all. All that and more on today's episode of The Marketing Madmen.
They say marketing is a madman's game. So now we turn it over to The Marketing Madmen with Nick Constantino and Trip Job.
Happy Saturday. Welcome to The Marketing Madmen. Trip Job and Nick Constantino here live from The Battery. And we've got a great topic today. So.
Yeah, I think we have a lot to cover in this one. We have a lot of, there's some issues, I think, that have been bubbling up in this country that I think we're going to touch on. But we're going to also touch on the nonprofit world and how to start foundations and how to find sponsorship. The way I always say this, to be good in a not-for-profit, you have to understand how for-profits work and some of the fundamentals of marketing and clients and communications. And when I see flaws with these nonprofits and any community organization, it's because they treat it as if that those things are not important. And PR is always important. Those fundamentals
PR
are always
important.
Important.
I mean, obviously, we'll get into fundraising. Well, fundraising goes back to your brand selling. A lot of the the basics,
yeah.
Right?
And it's a good point. You need a brand before you can get sponsorship.
Right.
Because no one's just going to take you on a word that it's worth a damn. So
who are we talking to
today?
So
that being said, with us we have Nehemiah Lamb. Nehemiah is the founder of Unique Individual Ranch. Nehemiah, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
It's great to have you. So before we get to all that, just give your background. Talk a little bit about what got you into this space, and then we can go into much, much, much more detail. We'll set up the problem at hand, and then we'll set up what Unique Individual Ranch does to solve said problem.
Okay. So once again, Nehemiah Lamb. My background is actually in industrial technology. So
okay.
I have a BS in industrial technology. Always growing up working at the YMCA as an after-school counselor, swim instructor. After graduating college, the industry was down. So I ended up working for the YMCA as a camp director for a few years and then child care director. And during that time, we were receiving kids that were on the spectrum. And at first, I had no idea how to approach or work with this population. So went to a couple of cool schools that work with kids on the spectrum to see the different programs and their techniques. And then we incorporated at the Y. After doing that, I felt that...
The Y in Atlanta?
The Y in Atlanta.
Beautiful.
I felt more needed to be done. So I resigned in 2015 and started with one kid. And kind of grew from there.
I love it. I want to take a step back.
Okay.
What do you think most people misunderstand most about the YMCA? So, in Atlanta, they are the title sponsor of the Hawks. I mean, that's a great thing,
right.
But it doesn't mean anyone understands what they actually do. So, so besides being a gym to go to and some childcare, just talk a little bit about the Y's mission and talk about why they're so pervasive. They're everywhere. They're such a big entity. Talk a little bit about that, because I think you got your fundamental base from an institution that has endured through countless generations and people. I think that's an important starting point.
That is true. The Y does have one main mission, and basically it incorporates everyone inside of the community, from early childhood education to senior citizens, so everybody come and can get program and services. So that was one of the main reasons, like growing up in a Y, that feel, that community approach, the different programs, different opportunities you had to grow and have a very interesting social interaction with various different people.
That's the most important part, right?
Which
it's
is
reflective
awesome.
Of the communities in which it serves, right? It's very
correct.
Inclusive. It's Young Men's Christian Association. But that being said, it doesn't. They want it's a community
Everyone.
Play.
Correct.
And that's why the name is not spelled out. It's a community play, and I think one of the things you talked about the economy being down. I think COVID. One of the things COVID did was it forced people to really realize their communities and how important those communities were. And I think the why people realized it was something that was there all along, but now, and with everything being more expensive, the nonprofit base, just the gym and using the basketball courts became that much more appealing. So it makes sense that they're on that upward trajectory that they would even be doing a Hawk sponsorship. So you were a camp counselor. So talk a little bit about the interaction with kids. What kind of kids you saw coming in? We'll dip into the autism and the spectrum. I have a lot of thoughts on that. But talk about the kids you were dealing with when you were at the Y.
Most of the kids were your neurotypical kids. your traditional population. Yeah. And then as the summers progress, we were receiving more kids that were on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Some of them were nonverbal. Yeah. Some of them with ADHD. Yeah. And they respond a little different from your neurotypical.
And I have to imagine the parents are just completely overburdened, and the parents are looking to remove some of the burden off them. Not in a bad way. I don't want to say it that way.
Right.
But, you know, that's got to be burdensome on parents.
And you probably, I mean, you're not trained, I would assume, at the Y, you know,
right.
For that.
For it.
Right?
Exactly.
I mean, and the reason I say that is back 35 plus years ago, when I was in college, we actually taught, it's very similar. I forget what the name of the program was. It's similar to what the first tee became for tennis. And so we were in Greensboro, North Carolina. And so we went 4 days a week. We went to two Y's, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And we did an hour and a half. We brought the rackets. We bought the balls. And, you know, at each Y that had a court, we would mm-hmm. there. And sometimes there'd be 20 kids. Sometimes there'd be 50 kids. I mean, you just,
oh, wow.
Every day changed. Every, you know, Y changed. But essentially, we were there to, you know, be part of their summer camps. And, you know, we taught the kids, and you just did the best you could. We were there to make it fun and mm-hmm. give them something to do in the middle of the day. We were never trained about,
you know,
how they interact with them.
But I think one thing you said earlier, Chip, is really important, right? You did that because of the brand recognition of what the Y is, that they had so many people willing to volunteer. Yeah. That doesn't come overnight. The Y has been able to establish over, I mean, when was the Y founded? I have to imagine it's 100 years. It's got to be something.
Yeah. Definitely over 150, yes.
So they are in the lexicon of Americana and the American brand, which mm-hmm. allows college students to say that is a cause that is worth my help, that they get behind, that they want to volunteer for. Plus, you know, no offense, but whacking a bunch of tennis balls around with 50 kids is fun. It's fun as can be.
Oh, it was,
That's a great time. Like,
yeah.
You know, at that moment, it's not even teaching. It's just hopefully these kids get some energy out. Maybe they want to watch a tennis match. Like, you're ambassadors almost. So
that was the goal. But, you know, you think back now to say, yeah, I'm sure there were instances where there were kids that we didn't understand why they were acting a certain way,
yeah,
right?
Because
we weren't
It's also
taught.
A different time, man.
Right?
I mean, you know, I joke, and it's such a horrible thing to say, and I really regret that I did this, but like the kids who were on the spectrum were the kids you threw the dodgeballs at harder. Mm-hmm. Like when you were in PA, physical education, you didn't know any better. Like the gym teacher would laugh harder than you did.
Right.
And I was born in the 80s. I'm not saying it's despicable, and I feel so bad for myself for doing it, but this is just as ADD started being understood. So because there's so much to impact about this, I'm just gonna give my quick two cents. One, my mother spent the last two decades of her life teaching gym to autistic nursery school children.
Oh, wow.
So imagine, she had four boys and we were all animals.
Yeah.
And then she dedicated her life to phys ed for nursery school autistic children. Now, the first thing, the reason she did it was because it was an immersion program. We have found unequivocally that separating these children with these issues is never gonna help the cause. Immersion is the only way to help it. But I do recall two or three times where I was out with her and we were by the school, but we were just grabbing lunch or something. And one of the kids who she took care of would be with their mother and head down and like never even eye contact with the mother. She saw my mother, the kid jumped across tables to jump in my mom's arms.
Oh, wow.
Now, that being said, my mom gets to see her for an hour a day, not the entire life. So as a parent now, I understand the frustration, but I think that from the time even you started, the way we talk about these disorders on the spectrum, ADD, you know, everything has changed so much. So before we get to why you started the foundation, the training you taught, talk about what you learned in those first couple of years and what made you realize that this was a field and something that you needed to go into.
What I saw in a couple of years that these kids were, even though they were inside of a group, they were kind of alone. So trying to get both groups to play together or integrate was a little difficult, and realizing that they saw and played and seen things a little different. So it took time to trying to come up with a program that allowed them to do both, be safe in the space that they're in and be themselves, but also engage with the other kids. Because some of the other kids, once again, as you stated, they will pick and make fun of, which does not help the situation at all. And it puts them more back in their shell instead of engaging with everyone else.
Yeah, and the spectrum has gotten so big. And it was always there, but we've just spoken about it in such broader terms that we're starting to understand the individual needs more. You know, look, there's a million conspiracies as to where these things come from, what the spectrum means, whether it be the food we eat, the biome in our gut, just we don't have to go into it. One of the things, one of the actual most the smartest, one of the things that makes the most sense I've ever heard, and if either of you have something, it's, I think, so in the good old days of this country, I'm throwing my air quotes, the picket fence, the usually the husband worked and the wife stayed at home. Mm-hmm. So people met at church groups and they met at places to yeah. which they really weren't similar in the sense of what they did for a living, okay? Now, because most people are meeting at work, you have two people who are nerdy mathematicians who meet each other. And that has caused a spike in some of these disorders because it took, let's say you're not the most socially person, and now you marry someone who's so similar to you, what do you think is going to happen with the offspring between the upbringing?
So the old opposites attract went away. Huh?
This is a theory, but if you really think about it, it follows a timeline. Just as women started hitting the workforce in the 70s, the kids that they started having in the 80s and 90s were the kids that all of a sudden the timing aligns with all of these things on the spectrum. If you take a maniac like me, and I just met somebody in sales who was screaming all the time, of course my kid's going to have ADD. Of course the kid's going to have ADD. Like, and then you give them the video games and all these things, and they have the red sevens. I just think that's...
So this is where Nick and I, you know, we differ a little bit, because the nerdy Nick wants to understand exactly how it happened, and I get that from the nerdy Nick.
No, I don't understand.
But the reality is how do we help the situation, right? Whatever happens. I mean, yes, there's a point where you want to have that research.
You're right, but my point was that what we understand about it has actually developed so fast. There is so much science being put to this. So when you look at it, like ADHD, what it used to mean was here's some Ritalin, okay? What it means now is completely different because there are different levels. Like, I have a short attention span. Does that mean I have ADD? Like, what is the definition of these things? So
I'm going to blame it on Barney.
No, that was way before Barney, bro. But then Barney came out, I was already watching Beavis and Butthead, which says a lot. But regardless, the point is that the spectrum has gotten so big, and I think it's critical to understand when we're talking about these kids, the difference from one kid with ADHD to another kid with ADHD is so different that they might not even be able to be around each other. The kid that's on the spectrum with some Asperger's or autism, what their thing is so off. Some of them actually enjoy it. Some of them don't want to be around it. Some have head issues or spatial, or they don't like lights. Yeah. We've broadened it so much, which the goal was to make it easier, but I actually think it has made it harder. Because now when we're putting these people into boxes, we're so specific with them that we're catering to them as opposed to having them blend into the bigger group pretty much. And I think, look, all stuff we're going to cover, I didn't mean to go down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, we're going to come back to Nehemiah, and we're going to understand a little bit about what he's doing now to really get at the heart of this issue. So when we come back from the break, we'll dive into a unique individual ranch. And you've been listening to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. We'll be right back.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men. Trip Job and Nick Constantino here with Nehemiah Lamb from Unique Individual Ranch. And now that we've got Nick's genetic background and makeup out of the way.
I said what I said for a reason. And I wanted to be a little controversial. All I was really trying to say was we do research, and the research is always about something about treatment or something about a cure. Never a cure, sorry. Something about treatment. So we do this study because we want to give medicine and shove it down people's throats to fix an issue to make more money for a pharmaceutical company. And all I said was, as opposed to treating a condition, we should start treating the people and the people with these things. No. And I think whether or not that's what Nehemiah does, that hopefully it is. But
let's find out.
I think so. So let's talk. Let's talk unique individual ranch. You said you started with one kid.
Started with one kid.
But before that, you did training. Talk about some of the training you did. Talk about the resources that are out there that what equipped you to go on the rest of this journey.
I would say my biggest training was experience working with these individuals. Kind of to your point, one of the reasons it's called Unique Individual Ranch because I like to treat everyone as an individual than a group. Let's say you have a 5 5-year-olds, right? They're still individuals, but a lot of people like to put them inside of a group. They're going to develop different.
Yeah.
They're going to think different. They're going to respond different.
I knew what I was talking about.
So, like, even in their group, you cannot put certain demands on them because they're inside of their group. So treating them as an individual, it allows them to grow at their pace, but also give them the opportunity to experience things different. So I guess a big misunderstanding that a lot of, I guess, the general public, they don't understand. A lot of people are scared of things they don't understand.
Yeah.
So a lot of the kids were finding out that I was finding out with the experience when they were coming to our programs, we were trying to force them to do something that they were not used to doing. And I say, if you go into another country and you don't speak the language, you're going to be frustrated. You get sent somewhere for a week, you're going to be frustrated. It's the same with their kids. But guess what? Once you understand this kid language, the door is open and then you can see progress. So instead of forcing things upon them, you take a step back, understand how they're communicating, because even though even some of the kids are nonverbal, everyone, whether you're verbal or not, they have nonverbal communication. So just trying to understand the child. So our programs are kind of built to, are tailored to the individual than a group. So you can be 5 or you can be 20. You're going to grow and learn different. And so that's how the progression. We work with the child as much as we do the parent, because sometimes it's hard to progress when the parent and you and the child are on two different pages, because the parent has an ideal of what their child should do. You have an understanding of what their child can actually do, yeah, and try to bridge that group together. Yeah. It's challenging at times.
And you're being nice with what you're saying. I have to imagine half the times you look at the parents and you understand some of the root causes of some of the behaviors also. And I know you were trying to find a nice way to dance around it, but you know, some parents suck and some parents are, some of these things are, it's just take this kid, get him away from me, as opposed to they want to learn together.
Yeah, like, some parents are vested in their kids and some are totally
and
divested.
In denial that this even exists. And like, no, this is a regular kid, this is a regular kid. No, that can't be. That can't be. As opposed to understanding early on and start seeing the signs. Because if you're in denial, you're not going to pick up the signs. And if you can intercept some of those signs at younger ages, then your chance of success for these kids. Look, it's a lot. It's a controversial topic for a reason. So, So you started with one kid.
One kid.
Okay. So talk about you scale now, and then we're going to build that time in the middle. Talk about scale now. How many kids are you treating? How big is the institution now? What are we talking scale-wise?
Currently, during the summertime, we service 37 kids during the summer, and after school, roughly 10.
Okay.
So
that's some substantial growth. And then you're seeing a more varied group of people, I have to imagine, too, from that one kid who is easier to give the one-on-one training.
Correct.
So talk a little bit about how you build programs, because I do understand routine and regimen is really important in these. So how do you take from one kid to 37? How are you building these programming? Are you working with experts and psychologists? Are you the guy that's like, you know what, in my experience, this is what I need to do? How are you building these programs out?
A mixture of both. Okay. So the beauty, I think, of our program is we accept everyone. So some programs only accept kids who are just nonverbal or has Downs or have mobility issues, and we accept everyone from nonverbal to behavioral to feeding tubes. And thankfully, our staff are special need teachers, so they know how to work with these individuals. And also we have nurse on our staff. So a big part of it, of creating these programs, is having a program that the kids is going to enjoy, and then also having staff that knows how to work with these kids.
Yeah.
So my thing is, like, a lot of these kids are really brilliant. They have a disability, but they really are. So I like to focus on their ability and not their disability, because once you give them the confidence to work on something that they can already do, then they have a little more confidence to work on things, other things.
So the programs become individualized then for each kid, or is it, you know, some there and some with the larger groups? How do you look at that?
So normally our ratios are 1-to-1 and 1-to-4. So socialization is huge. So even with a staff working on an individual, working with a kid individually, they're still inside of a group setting because they still need that interaction and know how to quote unquote, play along with other kids. So I like to say our programs look like your typical summer camp or after school, but it's adaptive. So if we're playing basketball, it's going to look different. If we're playing soccer, if we're doing arts and crafts, it's going to look different. But I want that kid to have the same experience your neurotypical kid can have. And unfortunately, sometimes whether it's programs out there, it looks different and they don't want to give the kids experience. And I think you can stunt their growth by not giving them the opportunity to learn, grow, just like everyone else.
I think, but also like most kids, unfortunately nowadays, we always focus on the winning. But I think it's also really important to learn how to lose. And I think in the instances, especially with these kids, yes, like you want to make this competitive, but everyone needs to get something out of it and understand you don't freak out when you lose, learn something and be better next time. And we don't even teach kids that. Everyone's going to get a trophy for everything. It's a shame in the world we're in. So how do you approach those things? Basketball is a great example. Let's use basketball. Okay. So these kids are playing. So obviously, go down, score the basket is different. Obviously, they're not as good with emotion, so they're probably more physical with each other somewhere. So talk about what a basketball game looks like. Talk about what kind of coaching is going on in that basketball game, because I think that visual cue will probably help people understand what you're doing.
Okay, so during our, let's say, a basketball season or a basketball game, so we'll have 30 minutes of skills. So basically, whether they're learning how to bounce the ball or pass the ball, they're doing that with the individual.
And this is repetition.
Repetition.
They just want to get used to the muscle memory, repetition.
Exactly.
Because if they get good enough at dribbling, they'll be more confident to do the rest of the stuff.
To do the rest of it. Right. Yes.
Okay.
And then the last 15 minutes is a game. So the game looks different because we have volunteers and staff working with the kids. But the ideal of it is that social aspect of it, too. Like, all right, we did something individual. Now we're working together as a team. So we have to pass it to our teammate. We have to shoot. Everybody doesn't like passing the ball, but you have to pass the ball. So it looks different. Yes, you're going to have meltdowns, but that's part of the process. Like if you're not having a meltdown, we're doing something wrong because the kids are not really doing something they kind of dislike.
How proud are you to watch the progress from the first time you do that to the end of, like, let's say your season? How proud are you when you see that progress?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. I think the joy of looking at the kid who's like, I did this, or they come and say, hey, coach, I did this, is really rewarding. And it's kind of fun because you see the parent who's like, oh, I didn't think my child could do this. Let them go. That's why we kind of separate the parent from the volunteer and
It's pretty neat. I mean, I lived in Roswell for many years, coached a lot, and so Roswell started a lot of adaptive programs. So I used to, when I was coaching 11, 12-year-old kids, we would actually go volunteer at the adaptive basketball. So we had kids from all different ages. And to your point, they were at that point, they weren't ready for the games. It was all about the skills, the interaction, you know, working. But to see the kids and to see how they also, to me, most of them were like 6, 7, 8 years old. And then you had these 12-year-olds. They love being able to play with, you know, these older kids. So that was kind of that social looking up, learning things from them. And to see the reactions was really, really neat.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
Great. What age are the kids mostly that you're working with?
We normally deal work with elementary, middle, and high school age kids.
Okay.
I would say 60% of the kids are elementary, and then middle school and then high. So this year we are working with the program that's like after high.
Yeah.
So a lot of the kids that age out of school at 22, having a program for them to come to because once they
Now they're on their own.
As well. Exactly.
And that makes it even harder. You don't have the protection of the system and the government and programs, so you're really on your own. So that's really awesome. All right, so we have an idea of what the kids go through. So what is the selection process, the application process? Obviously, there's probably in Atlanta, I would guess, in the hundreds of thousands of kids that need services like this. So just by how big the city is and just what I know about the population and everything. And again, the larger you make the spectrum, if we're talking, you're talking about kids with mental disabilities, physical disabilities, sensory disabilities. I mean, the gamut is just so big. So there's got to be so many. Everyone needs help. How do you do the application process? You know, where are you getting the funding to help these kids? How does all that stuff look?
Okay. So the application process, normally when I speak with the parent, they fill out an intake form. And after they fill out the intake form and I get a copy of their IEP, which is their individual educational plan, I normally have a meeting with the parent and the child because it gives me an idea of some things which you read on paper and then what you see, it doesn't really make sense, or what the parents
that's
would
like
fill
trip
out
with his online dating program. Yeah.
It doesn't align.
How does he look 40 years younger? What's going on here?
Wait a second.
Well, at least he's actually 6'6", so that's a good thing. 6'4"?
No.
Okay.
Close.
6'9".
One day.
Oh, 6'9".
With Elton John shoes on, maybe.
6'9".
That's awesome.
Yeah, all right. So that makes sense. So, I mean, so again, how many people are applying? How are you going through people? Because I can imagine going too big, you lose the attention and all the things you're working on. So how do you manage that part of it? It's got to be the hardest part. When to scale, when not to, how many kids to take in. There's so much need out there. You can't fulfill everybody. How do you handle that?
It's kind of working on both sides. Like, we do get some parents who are interested, but it's more of like marketing because we've been in that area where we started off in Sandy Springs and currently our home base is in Roswell. And a lot of the time the parents don't know like who we are and where we've been, which has been hard on the marketing because I don't have a marketing degree. But I do partner with the schools and other organizations to get our information out. And unfortunately, a lot of times parents move where like the school system is best for their child. So we might have them for one season, and then the next season they move to a different part of town. So it fluctuates and goes up and down. Yeah. But I think our growth is organically growing. So we're keeping our mission in line, and the process of the growth is going pretty well. So
do you have room for more people?
We definitely have room for more people.
So as a nonprofit then, how do you go about, you know, that, you know, sourcing the funds to staff, to scale,
And to market and to grow? That's a great question.
So a good question. 2023, so when I started in 2015, I was a for-profit. And I was in the red a lot just because our ratios are completely different from the YMCA.
The YMCA has the scale. You're talking mega things. Those properties were all pretty much gifted to them. They own the properties. Their costs are very little. Heating the buildings, staffing. They don't have to worry about finding location, website design. Most of that stuff's already pre-existing. It's not easy.
True.
It's more expensive than anyone thinks is. A good website with SEO is astronomically expensive.
Agreed. So 2023, I converted it to a nonprofit because I did want to serve more kids and then provide scholarships.
What did that process look like? I don't imagine they make it easy to convert these businesses and do these licenses. What did that process look like?
At the time, financially, the company organization wasn't in a place where it needed to be. So instead of paying a lawyer, I printed out the paper from the IRS, and it took me about 3 weeks to make sure everything was correct and sent it off. Yep. And 6 months later, I came back with the paper saying
Did they do any research that you know of? Did they look or they just read the paperwork?
I have no idea. I know the progress. Sometimes it says it takes up to a year, but we got ours back in 6 months. So thankfully, I'm assuming the paperwork was
and nowadays they know everything about you. I'm sure the community was saying about you was a helpful part. I'm sure that the government's like, wow, we need help. If he's doing this, it takes some burden off us to some capacity also. That probably helped a little bit also.
Right.
All right. So you're in a position. So talk a little bit about, you have some great sponsors and I printed them out and I forgot that paperwork. So why don't you rattle off some of those great sponsors, some we work with at this station in a similar capacity because they are community oriented. Talk about some of those sponsors and talk about what sponsor acquisition is like, because I think that'll be helpful for people in similar roles with similar institutions.
Okay. One of our sponsors is the City of Roswell. So we're able to use their space and provide program to the kids in the community. Recently, the City of Dunwoody, because we're providing adaptive sports. We're thankful for the Georgia Power Foundation that's able to give us funding, and also the Arthur Blank Foundation, which we're able to thankfully get transportation to transport the kids to field trips and after school and summer camp.
Are those grants? Are those things you're doing yourself? Are you just doing application processes? Are you going to meet with people? You know, to some extent you're selling this property, right? You own it, you're selling it, the guy, going out. What does your sales pitch look like? You know, where are you finding success? I think one of the things you're doing smart is you don't go into Arthur Blank and say, I want $10 million. Like, can you provide the transportation? It's tangible. It's real. They're not asking for money. You're asking for a call to action, which has got to be more beneficial, because everyone probably just says, look, I need $40 million. I think I'll just be able to do this whole thing. Cool, man. Yeah, get out of the office.
And there's a lot of great foundations in the City of Atlanta that I think are looking for very specific, executable type programs.
So what's that application process look like?
Right. So some of the applications that I just research, and thankfully I have an amazing board that have also expertise and network that I definitely rely on to get more grant information. But when it comes to partnerships with cities or parks and recs, I definitely go in and I look at the community first, because when you go in, I'm quite sure everyone has the same idea of wanting to partner, but making sure that need is there, because I never want to go into a community where the need is not needed. And also if it's there, I'm not going to go. Like, if another organization is providing that service, we don't need to be inside of that space. Right. So our mission and goal is to fill the gaps in different communities that are not being met. So the adaptive sports, all parents, not only the kids, but a lot of parents like to go on Saturday mornings and have somewhere for their kid to go. So going into those communities and saying, hey, this space is empty, so can we provide a service here? And on the application side, it's like everything else. Like, you're just making sure that you meet those qualifications. And then, you know, if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you just
have
to work
harder.
What
did you say your degree was in again in school?
Industrial technology.
Okay. So that makes a little bit more sense now, because what I'm hearing is, first and foremost, you're incredibly motivated. You know what you're going for, but you also know how to go about and do it. And you don't need to ask people to figure it out, right? Like, you're right. The biggest thing you can waste money on is lawyers. Yes. Lawyers' only job in life is to make it so ambiguous that you have to hire another lawyer to decipher the code in which they put down. Like, let's just call it what it is. So, you know, these systems are there. And one of the things I've been taught, you know, the Warrior Alliance downstairs is a great example. The resources exist. They all have communications problems. Yeah. And there's nobody deciphering which person should go to which service whatsoever. It is just like the smartest ones are probably the ones that need it the least, are the ones that have the easiest time finding access to these resources. Right. Like, I always tell people, one of the biggest flaws when you talk about New York City housing is that affordable housing, anyone in New York City can't afford to live there. So they're only giving the houses to the people who are just below upper middle class, as opposed to the people who really need the afford, because they're the best ones with paperwork, because they have jobs that know the paperwork and how to do this stuff. So, you know, I think it is clear that the way you have approached this is the way that most sponsors and business people would want to interact with. You do a lot of the work yourself. You have clear answers. You have it laid out. You give specifics, all the things you want in a business transaction. And I have to imagine that you don't probably think the degree would help you, but that degree probably is helping you do a lot of this stuff.
It has, definitely. Industrial technology with an emphasis in construction management. So the budgeting, marketing has definitely played a big part, and also been employed at the YMCA in a nonprofit space helped out a lot, because you're wearing many different hats and you just have to go out and just, it's more about the action behind it, because you can research knowing what you're talking about, but actually doing the work and following up, because you know you're going to get 100 no's before you get that one yes. So
are there areas that are, you know, just you don't enjoy or harder to do? I mean, I and sometimes people
doing
don't like
shows
fundraising.
Like this. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
No, but sometimes it could be fundraising. It could be, you know, the, you know, dealing with your sponsors, your boards. I mean, everyone's got a different area, but is there, you know, for people who are thinking about these nonprofits, what's the toughest thing for you?
For me, I would say is navigating personalities and relationships, because I do love growing in different aspects. And I found out the weak points I do have is because I really don't enjoy it. Like, I don't think I will be successful. So that's why I don't like thrive. But that's something I need to challenge myself.
Yeah, but you also,
if
you're self-aware enough to know that, that's what a board of directors' job is, right? You hire people that fulfill the gaps in the space. At least you're self-aware enough to admit that you have the flaws. The problem is people get into this, think they know everything, don't want to hire help or bring help aboard, and then that's when you're screwed.
Yeah, that's gonna be the biggest downfall. If you don't hire, just looking at our board, like a lot of areas that I'm not very knowledgeable of, that's where they're meeting those, because you're not going to be 100% knowledgeable of anything. But what you do is great. But those that you don't, the areas that you don't, like you stated, is finding individuals that meet that. Because if you try to do everything on your own, you're going to get frustrated and you're just going to call it quit. So
yeah,
you're definitely right.
Yeah, I love it. I think one of the things I want to talk about after the break, and we'll finish up here, but you know, how did we get here? Why are there not being more resources put towards this by the governments and the state governments and the city governments? I think we have a broader discussion of that, because you've probably seen some stuff just with the red tape and the bureaucracy and the paperwork that you know is getting in the way. I'm curious, because I think this is a problem that's going to only get worse. We talk about childcare as a whole. We talk about two parents have to work to make ends meet now. You throw in a kid on any part of any spectrum and the divorce rates go up. I mean, it's insane what happens. And we have not gotten to the root of the causes of the mental issues and all this stuff. So when we get back from the break, I definitely want to cover that. I think that'd be a good last segment. So the question I have for you is, when you were, let's call it 15 years old, did you ever think that you'd be doing this? When you were done with college, did you ever thought you'd be doing this? And what's the most rewarding part of it?
Okay.
Yep, we got it.
Okay. When I was 15, no. I thought I was going to be an engineer and building luxury homes and having a complexes everywhere. When I graduated college, I definitely did not see myself in this industry. But actually working in this space is rewarding. The rewarding part is not only working with the kids, but seeing the relief from the parents that they get, knowing that they have a place for their child to go to in a safe environment, an engaging environment for their child. So that will
be. You got to be a godsend to these people when they find out that you're there. It's one of those things where I was asking, you know, are you too big? Because there's so much need. The fact that you're not big enough means that the world is there's so much more you can do. And I got to imagine the look on a parent's face, not only when they just drop the kids off, but when they see the progress they made, the burden that's lifted off their shoulders. I mean, I got to imagine you get hugs every day from these people that are just like, you saved me. You saved my time. Yeah. You saved my marriage. You saved our house. Like we don't talk enough about how broken this is.
Yeah, the gratitude that's out there for someone to, you know, maybe even have a different perspective on, you know, ways that to unlock, right? You said that potential within their kid.
Right.
And then the second piece is, you know, I remember seeing it too. It's just that chance to sit back and let my, you know, shoulders down and just watch and be on the sideline for an hour. Right.
Yes.
And what that means to a parent out there. So great work that you're doing. I'm glad to hear about it. When, as Nick said, when we come back from the break, we'll dive in a little bit more to maybe what's next and how people can find you. So you've been listening to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. We'll be right back.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3. Nick Constantino here. We're going to finish up with Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, I think let's talk about just, I don't want to talk about how we've gotten here, but where we are. So as a whole, the childcare system in this country is relatively broken. In this country, the mental health, the issues that are pervasive in young children are just being a detriment on business and productivity and all the things we pride ourselves as Americans. I don't think there's any doubting that. I think everyone can argue how we got here, what the causes, what the fixes are. But I'm curious, I feel like we're at an inflection point right now, where if we don't do a better job of acknowledging these issues and working as a group to find solutions, that it's going to perpetually get worse, and the rate is going to go exponentially higher of how much it gets worse. I hope I'm not being a doomsdayer, but do you agree? Are you seeing that with what you're in, that we're at a point now where we really have to start putting either time, money, or something towards this?
No, I agree. A mixture of all three. Not only is this population growing, but the amount of programs and accessibility to these programs to parents is not great enough. And I think in the past, it has been like patchwork to kind of patch it, but not really focusing on how to meet the problem. So if we don't have a concrete or stable solution now to build on, 10 to 15 years from here is not going to look that well.
And I'm not going to get political with this. I have no intention to, but you are at the whim of new administrations and new sets of priorities, mm-hmm. and it happens all the time. And we just entered one that I don't personally imagine to be conducive to what you're trying to do. So, you know, it's work that you're out doing that you'll probably never get the gratitude or that for what you're doing, which is just sad. But so what do you think? What does the future look like for you? What does the future look like for the space? You've now had almost 10 years of experience seeing this. You've probably seen the people, the application progress, the red tape, the bureaucracy, the governments. You've seen more than most people ever will. What do you think are the biggest things that we can do to change that momentum to fix it? And how does your organization fit into that?
Wow, that was a lot. I would say it can be fixed.
Okay.
But a lot of times, if it's not in your face, you don't think it's a problem. So a lot of things that are not being addressed, they're growing, and then it's going to be in your face. So what we're trying to do is be ahead of the problem with the solution. So having quality programs for these individuals, having something different for this community is huge because, once again, it doesn't only affect the child, it affects the mom, the dad, the parent, which also affects their work when they don't have a place for these kids to go. A lot of time you do see relatives, grandparents, aunts and uncles who are able to watch the child while the parent is working, but that is changing a lot. Right.
That's an also, older generation thing. Right. Those communities, that's also because people move a lot. Like if I was in New York, I have 30 aunts and everyone, they can take care of my family. Anytime I need a kid to take care of, you snap your fingers and it's done.
Right.
People are separating much more. The communal ties, the family, the familial ties are breaking. There's no arguing it, which makes it a lot harder. It used to be it takes a tribe. That's what they say to raise a kid. Now you're pretty much doing it on
your own. Speaking of the tribe, and so you talked about scale before. So do you struggle at all with getting enough staff? I mean, is that something that's holding you back, or is it the funds to support that staff? I mean, what's you know, your vision? What do you need to keep growing this?
As of now, I have been blessed and thankful to have staff to have stayed with me for many years. So I wouldn't say it's the staff. It is definitely the funding, because it definitely costs more for a kid to come to our program than your neurotypical kid, just because our ratios are different. And then the amount that I have to pay to staff, because they are trained.
Yeah.
They do have that education behind it. So it costs more.
Trained
to pay.
And specialized.
And specialized.
Not just a master's, there's specializations. And each one requires something different.
Correct.
Right? I know even I have a cousin who's in speech treatments. Right, for kids that really can, and that by itself, there's a whole field of just that alone. Mm-hmm. And you have to have people who are specialized in so many different things, because if you're dealing with everyone, it's just so many people on the spectrum. So I believe it's very expensive, and it's not like there's not enough people out there doing it, but that also makes it more competitive to find these people.
It does. A lot of the parents who would like to come, they can't afford our care. So a long-term goal in the next 2 or 3 years, we would like to have, we're working on having a facility in a neutral community, that way everyone can come to, that sits on property that we can have after-school OT speech, basically like a one-stop shop for this community to come and provide programs. But that takes funding, and it also takes partnerships, community buy-in, and education from parents and organizations to know that, hey, how this community looks now is going to look different, and what are you doing to change the look of the community that's going to be created inside of the future. So we're trying to create one unique individual ranch that kind of looks like a Y, but for kids that's on a spectrum, and then also expand to, I know we talked about this earlier, into other states. So no, this is not something that's just here for Atlanta, but the board and I are working on expanding it to other states to meet the needs that are growing.
And that's where that regimen and discipline, that's where those best practices matter, right? You can't expand and scale until you have hammered down and make the best practices, and that's incredibly hard. You have 10 years to have done it, but I think that's incredibly hard. I think people always want to scale, and their eyes get really big, like, let's scale. But they forget, like, the problem with scale is that you go to a different state. You go suburban versus urban. You go to these city centers. You go to places that have less resources, less corporate
sponsors.
Regulatory
issues, right?
Regulatory issues. But what about corporate sponsors, right? One of the hardest issues I remember in D.C. is all the D.C. the decisions in D.C. were being made in New York.
Right.
There's no sponsorship happening in D.C. It's all being done in New York. So going from here to all of a sudden you're going to go to Savannah, well, there's nowhere near as much sponsorship money or corporations to support these endeavors there. So I got to imagine. So, again, I think you've approached it smart. I think that you've gone about it. I think, first of all, thank you for what you do. As someone who, especially with my mom, who's been around this and just seeing what this causes to families, I think it is the work you're doing. Tell people how to find you. Tell people how to help you, how to support you. Tell companies listening how their companies can be involved. I think the nature of community and charity is going to change very drastically over the next 4 years. But I also think there are some bad actors out there that play charity the wrong way and cash the checks the wrong way and declare the businesses the wrong way and are doing it for the wrong reasons. So it sounds to me like you have established the right reasons. So tell people how to find you and how to help support.
Okay. We can be found definitely on our website at www.uiranch.org. And then we're also on the social platforms such as Instagram and Facebook.
And then how do they support? You know, money's tight. Not everyone has money. What other things can they do to help the cause?
They can definitely come out and volunteer, which is huge. Volunteering at some of our programs, your time is definitely a huge help. To our programs.
Yeah. I love it, man. I appreciate it. So let's end with this. So, you know, I like what you talked about the ranch. Okay, so you called yourself Unique Individual Ranch. So tell me where I get the unique individual part. Right. That part's awesome. But the vision of a ranch is just a completely different thing. And there's not a lot of them in Atlanta, right. The one you're thinking about. So talk about the ranch and talk about how that plays into it, because you've created us almost like a utopian society with this ranch where everyone gets to kind of play and be around it. Talk about the ranch.
The ranch came into play. One, I love horseback riding. Growing up, we went to camps where, like family camps, they had a horseback riding, and therapeutic riding is huge for kids.
Yeah,
animals is huge for kids, the interaction. So having a place where kids can come in and have a quote unquote come into a facility where disabilities kind of cease to exist, where they're coming in and having fun. So having this ranch where kids can come in and just be themselves, but also,
it's a safe space.
It's a safe space for them to come in and get the treatment that they need. Yeah. So that's what we strive
to create joy and excitement too, right?
Yes.
Definitely.
Awesome.
It's amazing.
Well, Nehemiah, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate everything you're doing. And you know, if people want to learn more, again, you said uiranch.org?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. You've been listening to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. We'll be back next week.